One word, four letters, one of the keys to our inflation frustration. R-E-N-T. Rent. From American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 12th of July. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. The economic calendar says we are going to get the Consumer Price Index for June tomorrow morning, and it is going to be high. That is not a secret. But we lead today with a perhaps underappreciated part of that inflation story, the part that comes with the rising rents that we have been telling you about. Yes, the Fed is raising interest rates, and that should, emphasis on should, there, take a bit of the oomph out of the housing market. And so, eventually, rents. Emphasis there on eventually. The thing is, it's going to take a while for housing to cool down. And as Marketplace's Bree Benishore reports to start us off, it's going to take even longer for that to finally show up in the inflation numbers.
Renters, in a lot of places, are being bled dry. And at some point, there's just no more room to give.
I don't think we can go much higher from a rent perspective at this point, given affordability issues that are popping up all over the country.
Thomas LaSalvia is a senior economist with Moody's Analytics CRE. As renters reach their breaking point and as the labor market slows down, demand should too. Chris Mayer is a professor of real estate at Columbia Business School.
Slowly but surely over the next 6 months, we're going to start to see those rent increases, the month over month increases, you know, moderate and slow.
Moderate and slow does not mean rents will go down. It just means a 5% yearly increase instead of 10%. There is still a lot of built up demand to get through before we start to whittle down rent growth to something anyone would call normal. Elliot Eisenberg is a prominent housing economist.
We have potential entry level homeowners, people who want to buy an entry level home who can't. And then they move into the rental market.
And what the Fed is doing to fight inflation, raising rates, that's not going to touch rents for a while. Laura Rosner-Warburton is with Macro Policy Perspectives.
Well, so usually it takes about 6 months to see mortgage rates start to impact home prices. And then it could take another year before those prices eventually filter into rent.
And she says on top of that, the official measures of inflation, CPI, PCE, their measurement of new rents is really slow. So bottom line, rent growth may slow down, but it may keep propping up inflation for years. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Years. Wall Street today was a little bit of a downer. You could perhaps take solace, though, in this. A barrel of crude oil today, West Texas Intermediate to be particular, down 8%, $95 a barrel, $95.69 to be precise. AAA gas, $4.65 on a national average, down a little bit more than 2 cents overnight. Equities, bonds, all that jazz when we do the numbers. Next item got a whole lot of attention when Russia first went to war in Ukraine, but honestly, it's kind of faded since then. Food and the costs of war. We are now 130-something days into that invasion, and a report out from the U.S. Department of Agriculture today says global production of wheat, corn, and oilseeds is trending down, and supplies are going to be and remain tight over the next couple of months, which means, as well y'all know, prices for those commodities are going to stay high. Marketplace's Savannah Marr is on it.
Normally, by July, Ukrainian grain farmers would be shipping their spring harvest to Europe, North Africa, and Asia. Not this year.
We've had supply chain disruptions in the pandemic, but what we're seeing in wartime is on an entirely different level.
Anna Nagurny heads the School of Management at UMass Amherst. She says those farmers can't get millions of tons of wheat and sunflower seeds out of the country.
Because the Black Sea, the major ports are blockaded.
By Russian warships. And Nagurney says the war has driven up the cost of shipping commodities from elsewhere.
The price of fuel has grown. You know, there's increased risk. Obviously, the increased insurance costs and so on.
That means higher food prices all over the world. But Ian Mitchell with the Center for Global Development says that's most acute in countries that already struggle with food insecurity.
Countries like Afghanistan, Sudan, Mozambique.
And where households spend a larger share of their income on food. At some point, Mitchell says Western countries might have to make a tough decision
about whether potentially keeping millions of people out of hunger is worth marginally easing the sanctions on Russia.
If Ukrainian farmers can't move their spring harvests, Anna Nagurney at UMass Amherst says some won't be able to plant a fall crop, meaning the repercussions could stretch on for years.
And frankly, that is terrifying.
Not just for global food prices, but for global security. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
If you want to take out a loan in this economy, you might possibly have to do a little work, put a little time to upgrade your credit score or credit scores, really, because most of us have at least a couple of them, and they can be critical to our financial fortunes. So what are you supposed to do if your credit scores need a little polishing? Should you pay off old debts or somehow get your credit limit raised or maybe spread your debts around? Maybe. It's your call, but really, what you would actually be doing by doing that is that you'd be gaming the algorithms behind those credit scores. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains what that might look like in real life.
Credit scores can be a bit mystifying. They go up, they go down, sometimes without a clear reason. For Amber Miller, a certified financial planner in Minneapolis, that mystery was a challenge. I caught up with Miller and her husband during their beach vacation with their 11-month-old baby. She keeps tabs on her credit scores, mainly just out of curiosity.
At this point, it's, oh my gosh, if it's under 800, if then I'm like, what is going on, right? Because now I feel like I've tried to figure out the system, worked the system to get it to be perfect.
Miller had a general idea of what yields a good credit score, and yet she and her husband noticed their scores kept dropping.
We always paid our credit cards off in full every single month by the due date or before. And I didn't understand why then the score would ever go down.
So Miller tried an experiment. She changed how often she paid her credit card bills.
So the most frequently I ever paid off the credit cards was weekly. It did absolutely jump our credit. I mean, like every week it would go up 10 points for each of us.
Still, this is all guesswork. Credit scoring companies give broad outlines to their calculations, a certain percentage attributed to credit history, a chunk to the types of credit you have. David Silberman is a senior fellow at the Center for Responsible Lending.
But precisely what credit history means and how it's scored, or what types of credit means and how it's scored, that's all black box.
Nevertheless, there's a whole industry promising easy fixes to improve credit scores. But credit scoring companies, they know all the tricks and regularly update their models. Ethan Dornhelm is a vice president in FICO's Scores and Predictive Analytics Department.
A practice that became pretty popular a little over a decade ago was this notion of authorized user piggybacking, where people would basically rent out their sparkling credit card account. And for a fee, they would add people as an authorized user on their account,
thus boosting that second person's credit score. FICO ran the numbers and found that being an authorized user on an account wasn't a great predictor of credit worthiness. So, in one of the company's newer versions, FICO tweaked that algorithm. But not all changes are so obvious, and that leaves a lot of people guessing or listening to bad credit score advice, says the Center for Responsible Lending's David Silberman.
I think some folks who try may actually misunderstand what counts as good and what counts as bad. So they may actually do things which have the exact opposite effect from what they're intending.
And the consequences of getting it wrong can be severe. Safia Noble, a professor at UCLA, has written extensively about the role of algorithms in our lives. She gives the example of someone who has a bad credit score and no dental insurance. Let's say you need an emergency root canal.
If you don't have dental care and you have to finance that, right, a visit to the dentist on some type of dental credit card or credit system.
Many dentists and other specialists will offer monthly payment plans or loans to cover services. So now you're in pain and about to be in debt. But if you have bad credit, in our healthcare system, you might just go without treatment.
Having good credit or not good credit should not determine like your health and your well-being and your ability to see a dentist and other kinds of specialists.
And that's one of many reasons why some consumers pay for monthly subscriptions to stay on top of their credit scores or try to improve them. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This has been this past year and a half or so since COVID vaccines became widely available. It's been difficult times for Peloton, the stationary bike company. You get to exercise outdoors? That business model kind of gets challenging, right? There has been cost cutting and layoffs. And now today, the announcement that Peloton's going to outsource all of its bike and treadmill production to a partner in Taiwan. And that comes a little more than a year after the company announced it was spending $400 million to build a facility in Ohio to make its bikes and treadmills. So why the change of hearts? Well, a new CEO, and oh yeah, those costs, Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
Peloton's new CEO, Barry McCarthy, says he's focusing on the subscription model. Users pay $40 or $50 a month to get all the workouts. He's also cutting costs by outsourcing the manufacturing of the actual equipment. Ken Leon is director of equity research at CFRA.
You had a high margin licensing software business with about 65% margins. And then you had a equipment sales business that had anywhere from 8 to 12%.
As many companies learned during the pandemic, though, outsourcing has its own set of costs. Daryl West is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
The supply chain is vulnerable. There are security risks. There are economic risks. The costs have gone up. Energy costs are higher elsewhere.
Which, he says, has a lot of companies trying to onshore their manufacturing. But building a factory here and hiring American workers is more expensive and will get passed on to the consumer.
So if we try to onshore the components of most things, no one could afford to buy it.
John Austin directs the Michigan Economic Center. The key is what he refers to as ally shoring, weaning ourselves off of trade with hostile foreign actors, the Chinas and Russias of the world, and leaning into the relationships we have with partners like South Korea and Mexico. Because, he says, outsourcing low-paying manufacturing jobs is fine as long as the content and ideas are developed here.
You want to be the center of the brains of the industry that design the product, prototype it, do the engineering, do the software work, do the high-value things that nobody else can do.
And with so many used Peloton bikes available on Craigslist and Facebook Marketplace, the exercise company's fine with you grabbing one on the cheap as long as you pony up for the monthly subscription. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
How do we get nimbly somewhere when we've got a speedboat and a tanker ship?
I don't know. You tell me. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial subtracted 192 points today, 0.6%, closed at 30,981. The NASDAQ down 107, almost 1%, 11,264. The S&P 500 fell 35 points, 0.9%, 38.18. That decline in the price of oil I was telling you about, great news for airlines. Delta climbed 6.1%. Southwest ascended 4.6%. American flew just shy of 10% higher. The carrier said today it expects to report its first quarterly profit since 2019. The CEO of Gap stepped down, and the retailer warned that rising costs are squeezing its profit margin. Gap fell 5%. Twitter shares today up 4.3%. Probably not related. In fact, definitely not, because it came after the close. Twitter did actually sue Elon Musk this afternoon in Delaware Court of Chancery. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Emmy nominations came out today. You've probably seen the list already, right? We, though, are going to ground the story in our specialty by pointing out, as I did earlier, that we're going to get June inflation figures tomorrow, and that for all of its cultural and economic heft, which is substantial, entertainment is in no way immune to those rising prices. Winston Cho looked at how inflation is playing out in Hollywood for The Hollywood Reporter. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be on.
So right up at the top of this piece, you say that the entertainment industry is buckling under the weight of inflation. What does that mean, entertainment industry-wise?
So inflation and disruptions to the supply chain have gotten to the point where productions have had to start making choices on where they want to start making cuts. One physical production executive told me that one decision he's had to make is maybe a scene is 7/8 of a page. Is that scene really necessary? Can we combine it with another scene? Now, that would save $500,000, obviously a lot of money to these productions. So that's where we're seeing these cuts typically. I should say that some of these major studios aren't making these cuts yet.
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually, because if you're Studio X and you're going to cut your production budget $500,000, but Studio Y is like, yeah, you can have whatever you want, guess where the A-list star is going to go?
To the bigger studios, yeah.
Yeah. That said, though, there are some amazing things happening out there. There's some story in this piece about a production designer or a production executive, like not ransacking, but sort of picking through an old abandoned building that was about to be torn down so he could get like the lumber and the insulation and all this.
Yeah, that was a really fun story. The foreman of the set construction shop told me that he actually heard of an office building that was slated to be demolished. Now, he got the idea going through his head now that they can actually raid the office building for parts that were going to be torn down anyway. The main thing that they were going after is insulation, which set construction shops are facing a massive lead time for. So he raided the office building for that insulation and, other parts in the building, like light fixtures, spare parts, things like that. And, all it cost him was the labor to strip the building, basically. Hmm. So, that was a huge win for him.
Yeah, we should be clear. We are talking about hard goods, right? We're talking about lighting cables and plywood and those kind of things that go into building the actual physical sets.
Exactly. The parts and supplies necessary to actually build the physical sets. I'm not talking about the lumber or, right. Metal or, fabric or anything.
Right. Seems to me that entertainment and television shows and movies to some regard are especially ill-equipped to handle changes in inflation costs, right? Because, a regular store or retailer can pass those costs on to consumers, and the consumers, generally speaking, kind of got to pay them or buy something else. It's not like a studio can pass costs down to the moving-going public or the person sitting on their couch streaming Netflix.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they can raise the prices for their subscription services, but that's something that, they are obviously remiss to do. I mean, business is so big right now. Business is so booming that it's probably worth it for these set construction shops, for these studios to be investing, expanding constructing soundstage space right now. Productions, producers want this space. They need this space. And, stage operators there, they want to be able to provide that.
Important to point out here that a lot of these studios and production companies, I mean, nobody's shedding any tears for them. They're doing just fine profits-wise.
I mean, Disney committed around $33 billion, Warner Bros. $23 billion, Netflix like $17 billion to their content budgets this year. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of those companies have had tough years, but they want to get content out. They need to get content out.
Winston Cho, he's the business and legal reporter at The Hollywood Reporter. Winston, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Really appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
We have talked, Lord knows we have talked, about the Federal Reserve on this program and inflation and what Jay and the gang are doing about it, mostly with interest rates. But the Fed does have another tool, as they like to say. It's balance sheet. It's a list of sorts of the Fed's assets and liabilities. And right now, those assets, because of the central bank's big bond buying program, total just shy of $9 trillion. Dollars, which has gone a very long way to helping keep interest rates so low for so long. The Fed has started letting some of those bonds run off its balance sheet, which will mean exactly what, do you suppose? Marketplace's Lily Jamali has that one.
San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly's office looks out over the San Francisco Bay. The scenery helped her come up with her analogy of choice to explain the Fed's balance sheet. She likens it to a tanker ship.
It is big. It turns, but not with grace. It's not very nimble. You have to know where you're heading and what you're doing, but it ultimately gets you to the point of destination.
The Fed has traditionally relied on adjusting its benchmark rate, which Daly says moves less like a tanker and more like a speedboat. During the financial crisis of 2008, policymakers cut that rate to zero. With so little wiggle room to fix credit markets and help the economy recover, they turned to a less conventional tool for the first time, the balance sheet. And Daly says it's worked well.
I think it's an essential part of our toolkit because ultimately, we have to deliver on the support the economy needs.
But using both tools together can be tricky.
How do we get nimbly somewhere when we've got a speedboat and a tanker ship and we have to move them more or less at the same time?
Because the Fed doesn't want to surprise markets. Late last year, policymakers flagged their plans to start shrinking the balance sheet before they started hiking rates. Daly says the first interest rate hike in March might have come sooner if the balance sheet hadn't been a factor. And there's a lot we don't know about how the balance sheet works, says Harvey Rosenblum. He's the former director of research at the Dallas Fed and now teaches at Southern Methodist University. Like Mary Daly, Rosenblum has his own balance sheet analogy.
A new drug has been invented to deal with a particular problem, but nobody knows what the right dosage is of that drug. Nobody knows what its long-term impact is going to be. Nobody knows whether if you use it too long, it's going to be toxic.
And yet, Fed officials have triggered four waves of asset purchases that have expanded its balance sheet, a process known as quantitative easing, or QE. Three of those waves took place between 2008 and 2014. The fourth came in response to the pandemic. Rosenblum says originally, QE was supposed to be a temporary fix. But like many drugs, it's less effective the more you use it, he says.
And you need a bigger and bigger dose to have the same impact, but you keep getting a smaller impact.
As the Fed has scooped up assets to carry out this policy, some are asking, at what cost? Former Fed economist Andrew Levin, who's now a professor at Dartmouth, says the Fed now owns more than 40% of all residential mortgage-backed securities.
It's got a very big footprint in that market. All the market participants know that. The pension funds, life insurance companies.
Levin worries the purchasing spree has created the potential for distortions in that market and others. He's among those who's now analyzing the costs and benefits of the Fed's balance sheet program. There's much to learn about the balance sheet's effects on the economy, says Megan Green, global chief economist at Kroll and a senior fellow at Brown.
It's not clear that it's the Fed actually buying any of this stuff that moves markets. It could just be their announcement of an intention to, which moves markets.
The central bank has only tried to shrink the balance sheet once before, between 2017 and 2019. It had to stop after short-term borrowing costs spiked. That's the kind of volatility policymakers at the Fed want to avoid this time around. In San Francisco, I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I do believe is this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us. And yes, I know the micro-subscription economy is everything now, but this, Well, it seems excessive. BMW, we learned this week, is selling subscriptions for heated seats in its high-end models. $18 a month, $180 a year, $415 for unlimited warmth on your tushy. The car aficionados among you will know that the company has been selling microsubs for things like adaptive cruise control and automatic high beams for a couple of years now. But for us lay people, I don't know. Seems a bit much. It's all software, by the way. The cars do all have the physical parts to make the seats warm. You just got to pay extra to make it work.
Marketplace is supported by Indeed, a hiring solution that helps businesses attract, interview, and hire candidates in one place. More at Indeed.com/hire. And by C3 AI. C3 AI software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable problems. C3 AI. This is enterprise AI.
All right, here is your moment of economic context. A week ahead of Major League Baseball's All-Star Game set for Dodger Stadium, a mile or so up the road, by the way, from Marketplace World Headquarters. If you're going, you might want to bring your own snacks. Concession workers at Chavez Ravine have authorized a strike to start just before that game. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.